Go.
Okay.
Go.
What do we do first? I'll leave that to you.
Right.
All right. So what is happening here?
Well,
what do you see happening?
I see good things happening.
Yeah.
We are amending the soil a little bit. We've dug, double dug, which is pretty much the best thing you can do for your soil. Loosening it up with the fork. And then adding some of the compost-rich soil in. And then forking that in to mix it up. And then we've sunk your beautiful raised beds in. And we've used the level to make sure that it's pretty even, which is good for making sure water gets everywhere it needs to go evenly. And then we're going to move this all back in before we plant.
Wow.
Yeah, it's moving quickly.
It is.
Exciting.
My husband says faster than he can wire staple.
Talking to men, but these guys are getting ahead of me. They're working faster than I can work.
Okay. It's looking great.
Orange got a great saying because he said that, all of our life and stuff is based off of soil. Why do we treat it like dirt?
So, Christian, what are you up to?
I'm mixing compost with the soil.
Uh-huh.
To make more oxygen for the plant and more nutrients.
And then it goes into the bed?
Yeah, and then it goes into the box, yeah. So the topsoil is better soil.
Uh-huh.
And we mix with compost, it's high healthy content in nutrients. So it's very good for plants.
So the party crew is just people getting together and growing food. And I think, we already did that. We succeeded there. Check. But yeah, hopefully the concept and idea will catch on.
And where did you start? Where did you get the idea? Because you came up with it, right?
With a little crew of people, but we actually started the very first garden just 2 miles from here, over on Beach Hill. So very first garden, which we have a plaque at. It's looking great, by the way. And it was just a friend and I were traveling. And then we did a few more houses, as we went by. And then we said, you know what? Wait a minute. Stop. What if we did this in our own town? Hey? Now, I'm not going to lie to you guys. It did take a little while to get off the ground. But then, we put in just garden after garden.
Not just here, but also Southern California,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so far, I'm going to say 15 gardens have been done.
So what's your hope for this idea?
So yeah, the ultimate vision here is just that, each person here, everyone we talk to about it, will leave with the idea. And then they'll get together a small crew. I don't want to say pyramidal marketing scheme. But they'll, get 5 more people, and then those people will get 5 more. But then the idea is just that you go to any backyard and you make that place a food forest. And then you're catching water off the roof, you're improving the soil, and then every backyard everywhere just has food all the time. And then that harvest is shared, But then more so is all food we grow is our own sustenance, And then when everyone's growing right where they are, that to me would be an ideal scene. Yeah.
And not too far from where we started.
Yeah.
Isn't that the way human beings did it?
Yeah. That's what we used to do, right? We're kind of conservatives.
Great, Brian. I want to hear from Christian if this is a good time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm Christian Baez. I'm from Ecuador. This next 6 months, I'm going to spend time here with friends. Yeah. I have fun here. I think that I needed change my life in some way. And this trip and this experience made me think in more things that I can do in my country.
hungry the people in there. So I open mind with another cultures, another people, and this is really a enriched experience for me. Yeah, it's good to make friends, to work from place to place and make food for people. Now in Ecuador it's not common to eat vegetables, and people has not good quality in their food. So they made to include more vegetables, more proteins and vitamins. So, yeah.
So where in Ecuador are you from? City or company?
In Quito, is the capital of the country. Mm-hmm.
So urban gardens there might be possible?
It's possible. It's possible in the way that people want to change their customs and include more vegetables in their life. So, yeah. They can do it. They don't need too much space for make a garden, edible garden.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, my name is Alden Huff, and I'm just really happy to be here because I sort of have some similar ideas of what Brian is doing, actually doing, and I'm thinking about. Except his is I really like the celebration aspect of what Brian's doing. But I'd say, I guess we'll start, my story is when I went to India in about 1996. Mm. And I met a Swami there. It happened to be the day that my mother was going back to the United States. And he told me that he was talking about the Vedanta philosophy, the Hindu philosophy and stuff. And he said, "Oh, God is everything. Everything is God. You're God." Wow. That's great. Now, if everything is God, we should be treating this world a lot better than we are. In fact, we should be treating everything as God. Everything we should be doing, how we worship God, is how we live our life on this earth. So what are the implications of that? How do we live our life if the God and all beings matter? And I started to think about that. And I think, well, you would grow your food in the most compassionate, sustainable, and harmonious way that you could. You'd build your houses where it would be taking into account how it blends in with the bioregion, the ecosystem, and the other beings we share this planet with. How we think, we would be thinking in ways that would be spreading love and gratitude and good vibrations to ourselves, the people around us, the plants, animals, microorganisms, and the global consciousness that we all affect. So every moment of our life would need to be in this sort of aspect of reverence and worship. So I went around India and Thailand, Sri Lanka, Israel, and I asked a lot of the spiritual masters, you know, shouldn't we be living like this? And they all said, basically everybody said, well, you don't really need to worry about the world. It's an illusion. What you need to worry about is to purify yourself. And when you purify yourself, you're going to help the world. And I thought, yeah, well, that's true. But why not do something good for the world and purify yourself at the same time? And as, you know, we're going through this ecological crisis, it just seems like, you know, the thing to do. So there is a big divide between the spiritual way of being and, how you actually, according to my thinking, many people are perfectly comfortable with other ways. But according to the way I was thinking, that there is just a divide, is that you need to, your love and compassion to other beings, your worship needs to include all those other beings and doing something good for them. So I started thinking about ways of putting that into action, and came back and experimented at my mother's house. And then I went to a place called the Tree of Life, where they had a spiritual gardening apprenticeship. And I was apprenticed there, and I started to... Well, I thought I'd be learning for some master, but the guy who was there, it was like his second year gardening. And I came, and there was a bunch of dirt there, and we were double digging and starting a garden. But anyways, it was really neat because I was able to sort of, you know, experiment and learn and start to develop that program. And then after a year, he left, and they appointed me as the garden manager, and I continued with that.
Where was that?
It's called the Tree of Life in Patagonia, Arizona. It's a raw food, intentional community. So then I thought, well, or before going to the Tree of Life, I was thinking, okay, why not make gardening, farming, working with the earth as a path to enlightenment, where you're sort of combining all of these different things. So I came, after being the garden manager and Tree of Life and things like that, I saw that I was missing a lot. I need more skill, so that I have more confidence to do things and will be experiment more. And I just thought that the Tree of Life was going a little different direction that I wanted to go also. So what I want to do is have an eco monastery, or where you train people to combine that. Your worship is working with the earth, combined with meditation and those things, but you know, mindfulness practice, all these things, love and compassion that we do on our pillow or to Buddha or Vishnu or Jesus, you can do that to the world, to the living book of God, to show your compassion that way. So you can do all the spiritual practice and you can be doing something good to the earth. And also I think another thing that we need to develop is our intuition, our connection with nature, is that this is in our genetics. You know, we knew what to eat because we could sort of feel and communicate with the plants on that sort of subtle vibration level, just like the animals, because we used to live like that. So those parts are in our genetics, and I think if we can start to develop those things, then we can actually start to work with nature. And that's what we need to do, is we need to work with nature and honor nature so we can make this a better place.
Yeah, I'm from Ohio, from the country. And a few years when I was young, my parents had a muskmelon. Oh, that's what we called it. Cantaloupe farm. We grew cantaloupe. That's what they call it in Ohio. And I just thought that was so neat. And I remember thinking, even at that age, like how weird it was that like none of the food in the store, like you didn't know like where it came from, like because we would sell it directly to the grocery stores, which I don't think is done really anymore. And so that was really neat. And then I just remember thinking how it was weird that where does this other food come from? And we were surrounded like by lots of corn and soybean fields, and I remember always like asking, like, why are, you know, can we eat this? Why are we eating this? And, you know, it's all going to feed animals, you know. So again, we're not seeing the food that's being grown. And then when I moved out of my parents' house, I just tried to grow as much food as possible, like just in my little backyards in the city, and just grew from there. I just love growing food and knowing where it came from. And I think we just need a lot more of that going on, especially like China is losing that. For so long, they were able to sustain themselves. I mean, they were really into sustainable agriculture for forever. And now they're losing that. And so to balance it out, we need to start doing more of that here. If you think of like China being the new U.S., we have to become the old China. But yeah, let's grow more food, everyone.
My name's Erin, and I also grew up in Ohio, about a half an hour away from Adelaide, though we didn't know it at the time. I'm sure we were at the same place at some point. I feel like my connection to gardening and growing food really comes from my family, and and I'll probably keep crying, but I feel like sharing this right after we got here this morning. I got a phone call that my grandmother died this morning.
Right after we got
here. Yeah. And it's been ongoing. Like, it wasn't a surprise, and I actually feel better now than I had the last few weeks. And I just feel like I wish I were with my family, but since I can't be, I don't feel like there's any better way to spend today. So I was really glad to be here. Because my grandfather is really, like, my first connection to gardening, and, like, growing up with him in his garden, and that passed on to my dad, who gardens like crazy. And as a kid, I thought it was the most boring thing in the world. And then after I grew up, when I was in college, I developed a really strong interest in social justice issues and environmental issues, and then discovered that growing food was a really great way to bring those two interests together and also feel like I was connected to my roots and my family in some way. So.
What's your grandmother's name? What is
Marjorie Harvey.
Marjorie Harvey. Couldn't we call this the Marjorie Harvey Garden?
Yes.
That'd be really nice. Really nice way to keep things growing. And,
I love it just to call it the Marjorie Garden, because that was my grandmother's name. Who loved a garden. That's how I first loved the gardening, too.
Well, my grandmother did not love to garden. Oh. I don't think she ever set foot in my grandmother's garden. She would stand in the door and holler for it to come back in. But she always put up a lot of produce. Like, she was always in charge of making juice and freezing fruit and making jam.
No.
So I think she kind of resented the garden because...
If we could name it the Marjorie Garden, I'd be very pleased.
Sounds good.
And we'll plant marjoram and rosemary for remembrance and all that. Well, I'm just very inspired by all of your examples, and I couldn't believe it when David first called me and said, this is my idea, and this is Brian's idea, and I said, Well, I don't quite get it. Nobody I've talked to gets it yet. But I think the only way to honor your gift and also where you're coming from and the parents that made you and all those experiences is to be grateful, be joyful, and harvest and pass it on. You know, and I'm really with you on that. And I consider it your garden as much as mine now. So
imagine a world where food is growing everywhere.
Everyone, underlined, is tending the land and sharing the harvest.
Wonderful.
And I thank Teresa Caraggio from Third Paradigm Radio for making that audio available. We'll conclude with an interview by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, with an activist in Portland who clearly understands the problems and is working to implement solutions, very much in keeping with the age of reunion.
Down here on the corner of ruin and grace, I'm growing weary of the human race. Hold my lamp up in everyone's face, looking for an honest man. Everyone tied to the turning wheel, everyone hiding from the things they feel. And the truth's so hard, it just don't seem real. The shadow across this land. But we'll all be burning in the same big sun when the great correction comes.
A lot of people are finding out they're bankrupt or worried it could happen to them. The big banks are really insolvent and the government is really broke. All of them just knew the economy would keep on growing forever. and they could have found out otherwise from this week's Radio EcoShock guest, Jan Lundberg. Jan grew up in a family famous for tracking the oil and gas industry with the Lundberg Letter. He left that in 1986 and then discovered peak oil and the environment a couple of years later. Jan Lundberg has become a well-known writer and energy activist. His website, culturechange.org, has attracted a movement of like-minded thinkers who want to bail out this sinking good ship Earth. So let's get to these real issues, Jan. You say you discovered peak oil in 1988. When did you start to realize that climate change was another flaw in the fossil fuel civilization?
Well, it was that same year. There were some terrible heat waves back east, and as I was moving my career into environmental protection, away from serving the oil industry and government in 1988, I happened to have dinner in D.C. on a hot summer night with somebody with Environmental Defense Fund, and he told me that this heat wave actually might reflect the global warming which had indeed begun. I said, no, come on, you're kidding. He said, no, it's for real. So that was when, and that was the year that Al Gore, you know, held the hearings where James Hansen of NASA talked about it. So that was everybody's wake-up call, and that was mine too.
Well, it's such an ironic universe, these fossil fuels, that they've almost led us into a self-made technical evolution, and then they turn out to be lethal to the planet's ecosphere. But there's still divided camps, I find, on the web and in speaking to people between those who are sort of really working on peak oil and those who are working on the climate. And I'm wondering how we get these folks to understand that they're both part of the same big problem.
Well, they certainly are. I found that some peak oil activists are not really environmental activists, so they're kind of lamenting the loss of all this extensive energy that people have been using like there's no tomorrow. And so they're upset about losing consumer conveniences. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize, but that's just one of the reasons that can account for someone really not placing climate change as high up in the level of concern. To me, in the last several years, I've noticed that climate change and petrocollapse, or the effects of peak oil, have been in some kind of a race. And it used to be that several years ago, people thought, well, climate change is going to come sometime in the 21st century. We're going to be suffering the effects. And every year that went by, things seemed to accelerate. And meanwhile, the collapse from our petroleum dependence, from the overbuilt economy and all the financial funny money, this seems to have gotten a reprieve here and there. They could extend the whole growth machine with the WTO and wars, and that has managed to put things off. So collapse of the economy hasn't quite hit as fast as some of us thought, but we see the climate collapse accelerating. It is, of course, quite intricately related.
Yeah, well, I'd like to get your take on some recent news. On August 20th, during the sleepy summer holidays, the White House approved a pipeline to carry dirty tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to the American refineries. And this line's from the Enbridge Company, and it's called the Alberta Clipper. Well, the deal was done by executive order, not through Congress or the usual branches, allegedly as a national interest determination. Now, that means a lot more greenhouse gases from the tar sands, and they're possibly the most energy-hungry oil sources on Earth, just to fill American gas tanks. What happened to the green, climate-aware Obama White House?
Well, I don't know if that's really the right question. Those of us who were looking at the reality of the role of government and serving its corporate constituency, we knew that the Obama regime was not going to be all that green. I think it's important for people to see energy reality than to get their hopes up in, you know, reforming the political system. And about the tar sands, this is something that is never going to really replace much of the conventional oil, which is dwindling fast.
But Obama says, well, he's going to leave emissions control to Canada. Well, the atmosphere doesn't care who's to blame or if you slough it off onto another country or blame China. I just don't see this working at all.
Exactly. As long as the present economy and powers that be are in place and petroleum can be extracted and refined and distributed in the quantities that, you know, the world economy is demanding, really nothing is going to change. So it is going to be more of a collapse, a situation for things to really change politically as well and in terms of how we use energy. And this could benefit the planet, except when things are really getting out of control and there might be some more damage to the environment, or if we fail to babysit the nukes, then you can't say that collapse is just this wonderful favor to the environment.
The only thing that would really stir Americans and Canadians into action are the prices at the pump, that as long as you can do it, whether it's from the tar sands or any overseas war you need to make, as long as those prices at the pump are there and we find the gas we want, well, then we'll just go on living the way we've been going. Is that the story?
Well, of course, the idea is, and this is Barack Obama's agenda as well, keep it going. Just keep the status quo going and don't panic. Keep buying. Keep the corporate profits up. Our way of life is wonderful and privileged, and we have to, you know, keep enjoying it and pay all the costs, even if it's others having to shoulder that burden.
Well, I noticed, too, on your website that you'd highlighted an article about the ocean temperatures being higher. I think it was in July than ever recorded. It's foolish to try and forecast the future, but what is your best guess about where this climate is headed?
Well, it's quite a saddening and frightening prospect to sense things getting out of control. We grew up with the comforting notion of the sun coming up and the weather being something we can deal with. And we also had the food and water that we needed. And now when you think of crops failing or disasters caused by climate disruption, then all bets are off. So the world as we know it is coming to an end, and we're going to have to, if we cannot just terminate greenhouse gas emissions as they should be right now, then we have to accept the fact that things are just going to get worse and worse, and there's a lead time built in. We're not going to be able to just stop it. There were some campaigns centered around the idea of stopping global warming. This is impossible. It's in the pipeline, and there are going to be positive feedbacks that are already taking place, like the melting of methane crystals under the sea. So it's a scary situation. I suppose that there could be a silver lining in the sense that there could be a sudden realignment or adjustment that nature causes us to adapt to. And we'll have to be kinder to the Earth, probably because we'll no longer have the capability of destroying what's left of the climate. But it probably will be economic collapse and the lack of fossil energy to continue that'll really get us to change.
Well, I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Jan Lundberg, a former oil and gas insider, now an agent for a new energy economy and the social change that requires. Did I describe you correctly there?
Well, I have not really subscribed to the idea of a new energy economy. I believe that there will be economies plural. I believe that with petrol collapse and such climate disruption, the surviving pockets of humanity are going to be quite sovereign and separated by natural boundaries. And, you know, if we stop and think about it, why should we be getting food and such from many, many thousands of miles away, foods out of season? And what do we really need from the other side of this continent? why should we be taking orders or following an agenda that is set on the East Coast if we're living on the West Coast? So there are going to be changes in that regard. And this has to do with energy very much in the sense that what has been built is a very centralized, inefficient system. So when it's decentralized and local-based, it will be the particular forms of energy that are available for an ecosystem. And if we're not producing energy that we don't need for a huge population of consumers with redundant appliances and their own cars and computers and so forth, then it's going to be not really an energy economy, but an economy integrated with the ecosystem. And then we'll just be using energy as a matter of course, like people did for thousands of years, where energy was built into the food, into the timber they used, and so forth.
So you're talking about indigenous people and their energy balance. I wonder, can we really learn from that? And if so, what could we learn from that?
Well, we're kind of working on that at Culture Change. I have a colleague named Rebecca Lerner who has been posting articles on primitive skills and sustainable living through indigenous life ways. And when we stop and think about it, Native peoples are really the only model of sustainability that we have. And how much have we lost from that wisdom? We're not even retaining our own culture's wisdom when grandparents pass on and they haven't been able to teach their children and grandchildren, and instead they're farmed out to nursing homes and they're not raising the young generations, then we really don't know how to manage in a world without things delivered to us with fossil fuels. So there are great changes ahead, and we need to look at everything we know that we've developed that will fit into the future sustainable culture and go back to look at how the indigenous traditional ways provided all needs for millennia.
We have to think about future generations, obviously, and we don't do that. We don't think in the business model beyond the next quarter or the next coming bonus for the big executives, because we know that there are places in North America and around the world that are just draining down their water tables, and when they're gone, they're gone, their fossil water supplies. Or just think of the way we're using oil. We presume, well, we'll just burn it all until it's gone. I'm thinking, well, maybe three generations from now, they'd like to have a little bit left to run something really important, like an ambulance service or something, but we don't plan for that.
That's true. And if we could be rational as a people, there would be some really intelligent planning. But since that's not being done, and since we don't see a social movement to turn things around or to take over and offer new leadership, then we have to anticipate collapse, and we have to put into place today the models and tools of sustainability. And that's a wonderful thing going on here and there. There is permaculture. There is eco-villages. We're trying to start the sail transport network. We've operated pedal power produce. And so these kinds of systems and ways of thinking that also bring people together, which is so essential for people to have that community and closeness that they've lost in the consumer economy. All these things are going to help us when they're needed most urgently, when the trucks stop pulling into the supermarkets.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to that day myself. I mean, we depend totally on fossil fuels for a lot more than cars. It's plastics and it's, you know, pesticides, fertilizers, electricity. Can we talk a little bit about the impact of declining fossil fuels on our food supply?
Well, petroleum is the way we grow and process and distribute and cook and package our food. And it is such a ridiculous dependency for the vulnerability and the unsustainability that this presents, that you'd think there'd be much greater concern and some planning and a move to get away from that dangerous situation. But the most we're able to see is with the recession, gardening is up 20%. And some people have not bought new cars. They're fixing existing cars, which I totally approve of. I mean, I've been car free for 2 decades. But if you're going to buy a car, let's buy a used car. Let's not hand the corporations money for new products. So when people are not even using cars and they're using bikes and hooking up bike carts and they do some depaving and take some space back from the car, we're creating local food supply. People are getting together and providing for themselves instead of wondering about how they can get some more cash to give it to strangers for a product produced by people far away who are unknown to them. So we see some positive changes, but very few people are actually involved in trying to prepare for the future. People are generally forced by circumstances to change, and it could be too late for massive famine if people are continuing to assume there will be unlimited energy for food production and distribution.
You know, we've been fed so well for our whole generation, and you know, so much of the population is overweight or obese. And I think September 11th attacks, they showed, among other things, that people far away may not quietly starve to death while we gorge ourselves. With global TV illuminating the stage, is it possible that North Americans will begin to know what hunger really means?
Only when they feel it themselves, and then they're going to be very surprised and angry and will be quite violent about it, perhaps. It's going to be like a national Katrina. In this country, people are less prepared for this kind of disruption because we're using the most petroleum per capita, I think. I would say that the reason things are so urgent with petroleum, and I'll put on my oil industry hat here, the way that depletion works and oil supply disruption works, it's really the oil industry market, the market that determines how much supply is in the system that matters much more than reserves. We've heard about peak oil, and there's a theoretical bell curve that goes with it. And it is assumed by many, including peak oil authorities, that there will be a kind of a smooth downslide, diminishing of oil extraction, which would then be refined and distributed. However, the oil industry is not set up for shrinking, and certain aspects of it, such as refining and producing from wells, don't lend themselves to a ratcheting down whereby you'd have an oil industry at 60% and then 40% and then 20% of what it is today. So if you look at what is available in terms of petroleum products urgently needed and furiously distributed around the world today, when that is tripped up by a supply shortage to the tune of 9 or 10% or more, then you have skyrocketing prices, panic buying, and hoarding. When that happens, it doesn't matter how much oil is in the ground or if a new refinery was built somewhere. What happens is the people can't drive to their jobs. Businesses and factories and institutions can't get deliveries. And you have people unable to get the food they want. And supermarkets will be stripped in 3 to 5 days. So it really is a matter of great sudden and chaotic adjustment to something that really isn't there yet. There is no energy substitute waiting in the wings that can be scaled up to substitute for petroleum. And the ones we hear about are really for electricity and not liquid fuels anyway. So we have quite a dangerous situation right around the corner, which really doesn't have a lot to do with whether tar sands can be built up much more than 2 million barrels a day refined or not, or if more solar panels can be put up or more wind turbines. So if we've greatly exceeded our ecological carrying capacity through all this very cheap energy, but it's gone. The remaining energy doesn't have the net energy characteristic, the high yield that it had in former times in recent decades.
So we could have a breakdown in the distribution system that would radiate outward to create an economic crisis, which then just can't cope with it at all.
We will have this, and it will be very rapid, and we're not prepared.
Wow. So this, I guess, is where the localization movement comes in, is almost like a lifeboat type philosophy of, well, let's have some areas where people will be able to cope. Is that the idea?
Absolutely, and that's what the Back to the Land hippies figured out back in the late 60s. And it's never really gone away. It's had different names, and there have been communes. There have been just folks trying to maximize their own food growing, and we were promoting this with the Auto Free Times magazine when we were managing the Alliance for a Paving Moratorium, and it's great that knowledge of peak oil and localization have become much more appreciated.
It must make you tear your hair out to see the Obama administration and governments around the world. They're doing the same thing here in Canada, announcing multi-billion dollar bridges and nine-lane highways and lots more paving just at the time when that's obviously the wrong way to go.
Well, it is, and there's a lot of jive associated with it, such as jobs. Well, if you want jobs, you fix the existing roads that would employ 10 times as many people. So it's really about the same old, the old boy network and speculators, high profits, expansion, urban sprawl, and they've just put a green face on it by saying, well, there will be a few more crumbs for bicycling and greener this and that, and maybe traffic will be functioning smoother if we pave everything over. So this is something people should not buy, but it's been going on for many decades, and it's not going to stop until there's either complete financial collapse or the kind of interruption in oil supplies that will bring about the final and largest aspects of petrol collapse, which I believe has already begun.
It could be eerie to see these gigantic roadways with people who can't afford the gas to drive around on them. They'll be rather emptied out.
Well, we bicycle activists have been saying for a long time that there's going to be a lot of big bike paths out there with plenty of room.
Well, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and we're talking with Jan Lundberg, a former oil and gas insider, now proposing radical cultural changes. In fact, you call your website culturechange.org. Why do you do that?
Well, culture change seemed to be the key to what was puzzling us. In the late 90s, we noticed the best farmland being paved over. And we noticed on the family and individual level, people were so separated and stealing each other's inheritances and family. And all of this pointed to a value system that was way out of whack. So a change in culture has been happening. It needs to accelerate in a good way. And so that's what we chose, instead of to focus on energy or transportation.
I think you've got close to the core of the issue, in my opinion, because we have the facts now about peak oil and about climate change, and yet we're stuck in a rut, to use the old car culture language. We can't seem to change the way we think. That seems to be the big problem, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and we can only think in terms of what's around us and what we've been taught. I had a very strange upbringing. I was brought up on an organic ranch and sailed from California to Greece. And my father actually was doing something you're doing now, a broadcast journalist. And he had the first talk show on in television history in Los Angeles in the 1950s, a muckraking thing. So, yes, someone like me has looked at the problems around us and the possibilities for a better way of living, and I've been happy to try to share that. Some people just go for it, even though they've had a very traditional, conventional upbringing, and they just go right for the changes. So it's sort of an inclination some of us have, or just the good fortune some of us have had to think differently. But that is really what's required, and questioning what we've been taught and trying to unlearn that. And then taking action, that's the other big factor here that is crucial.
Well, just for the sake of argument, some of the solutions you advocate sound like going back to pre-oil technologies and ways of life. And other people have argued that technology may not be reversible, that we're almost you know, part machine ourselves now. So 6 or 7 billion people can't really go back to the land. How do you answer that criticism?
Well, it's absolutely true that we've outstripped carrying capacity to all go back to the land. So ultimately, when there will be a much smaller population size to use sustainably what's available, we'll be closer to nature. Otherwise, we won't make it as a species, and we'll continue to drag others down towards extinction very rapidly. But when it comes to how technological we are and whether that can be turned around or not, I think people are confusing, technology with energy and vice versa. So when we have had cheap energy, such as 100 barrels per 100 barrels of oil per one barrel that was input for the extraction, when that kind of net energy was possible, and it's not happening anymore, amazing things were done. And the chemistry of what can be done with petroleum has really been phenomenal and mind-blowing, but it has served to poison the earth and our bodies, such as what plastics do, and they're filling up the ocean, something terrible right now as we speak. It is important that we question the notions of progress and growth, which this civilization has depended on. But at some point, it's the end of the road, and we have to take a much narrower path of nature.
We're talking with Jan Lundberg, and another argument I hear, Jan, is that the current economic crisis that we're seeing in the Western world may actually be a rebalancing. We've taken for granted that most of the world's resources come to America or Europe for consumers. I can't believe we actually bought that as a model. But now some of that is going to Asia, at least, where people in India and China get some electricity, some roads, some televisions, and maybe some more consumer goods. Is there a kind of justice as Americans use less and others get more?
Well, you could look at it that way. You could also see a poetic justice in millions of basically native peoples coming from south of the United States border to repopulate what's known as the Indian, or in your country, the First Nation populations. But when it comes to other industrializing countries using more fossil fuels and stripping their topsoil and water supplies, this is simply an unfortunate development which will not serve them in the long run, and we all suffer the climate effects of those activities. And it's also true that in the United States we lose our skills and our resources and our means of managing our lives. When we become a third world nation of service employees, and we are obtaining products from far away, from people we don't know, shipped via petroleum, this is something that reflects a very quick change in our people. It's a generation of unskilled, unprepared consumers. And so when other countries are supplying the products, and they themselves are enjoying some of these products for the class of people that can afford them, then this is just part of the whole global change that has to do with manipulating nature and stumbling upon this bounty known as petroleum. But it's coming to an end. Peak does not mean the second half of petroleum consumption is unfolding. No, it is a completely unknown world we're stepping into, and it can be very rapidly changing.
That's unbelievable. You know, car sales in China were higher than in the U.S. last year, and they're building more roadways, and I understand that Buicks are really popular there, nice big cars. It seems like oil is almost a drug that gets people high and then it kills them. It's like a disease that's spreading out over the world, I feel.
Well, sure, and it is an addiction of some kind. It's important not to focus just on petroleum, because a lot of people imagine, well, there's a clean substitute we'll be able to continue our lives as very sophisticated scientific people enjoying modern convenience and progress. This is something that is actually a dangerous and wrong-headed view, because there is no real substitute for petroleum with all its flexibility and versatility. And when people are depending on petroleum for their transportation and agriculture and the plastics, this is something that is crucial to recognize and to try to plan around, but to try to extend it is folly and is a big disservice to everyone. So we have to boycott and walk away from petroleum as much as possible, and that, I think, is probably the best social movement, a strategy for rapid change, and to kick the system where it hurts and begin to use our own resources and capabilities in our own smaller communities and cheat the corporations out of being enriched.
Well, according to the latest news, the people who own the big corporations have been cheating the taxpayers, heading off to Switzerland and other places. But, you know, anybody who looks through the web or reads the papers, the headlines keep coming along, unheard of events, things that are so jaw-dropping. I could go away for 2 hours and think about that one thing, but there's 20 of them. And at the same time, I can't escape this feeling of stagnation. We aren't changing much. The government can't do much, as Katrina showed us. And the same crooks run the banks and the stock market. It feels like suspended animation, but a big storm is raging outside a solid plate glass window, and it feels so ominous to me, and I know a lot of people are worried deep down. Are you sensing that?
Well, yes, there's a bit more of that, but being basically an optimist, I think that it's liberating to view things in a stark fashion for the first time. If people can picture modern humanity as mostly slaves, with another good many of us living off the sweat of others, then it puts a different light on what's going on, instead of here's a news item on some scientific breakthrough. The corporate media serve to distract us. So if we're able to change our lives and keep moving in a direction of liberating ourselves from the thuggery of those in charge who are dressed well and speak so well, it's still oppression and exploitation for people and nature. And to reject that and to work with those who see a better way is quite pleasurable.
You've talked about several good ideas that could give us hope. Can you expand on that a little bit? What are some of the ideas that are happening on the ground in the real world that you know about?
Well, as I mentioned, when we can link people together with a local food supply, and people are cooperating and bartering and not commuting off into the distance, wrecking their health and the commute, and earning dollars to trade for things that should be free in nature anyway, or produced in their community. These are trends that actually are rather hopeful, and it's all inevitable. You can lament the loss of this technological boom and all the convenience. You can say, well, I need my car. You can say, well, maybe some more oil will be discovered. But all of this is quite inevitable in the direction of a real community culture. And so you see things happening like you've heard of the 100-mile diet. Well, here in Portland, some people are practicing the 5-mile diet. There are some community gardens in former front lawns. We're trying to hook up with bike carts and sailboats, a system that will allow people to have some food security. Now, we have around, you said I was in California. I was until several months ago. I'm in Portland, Oregon nowadays. And we did demonstrate that a lot of food can be bike carted, and we got some of it delivered with sailboat as well. There is so much to integrate, so many pieces of the puzzle that are good developments and hopeful, that it will create a food security system where distribution is by appropriate technology. And there's an ethic here to really eat local. It is such a point of pride. The average restaurant is featuring local vegetables and fruits and meats whenever possible. It's just sort of a bubble in the United States.
Well, you know, you've really inspired me here, Jan, because I had the feeling that there's nothing we can do to stop the decline and the destruction. But you've also brought up the point that there's nothing we can do to stop the healing and the rearrangement that humans will make.
Yes, and it's really our true nature. We lived in a tribal communal fashion for, you can trace us back to 200,000 years roughly. And this is what we knew. We didn't know the corporate state or environmental devastation except by natural forces. And so if we have to go back, as someone might call it, at least what was known in the past was the closeness of the village community, people working for the group, and having the extended family, which, if we look around in North America, it's supposedly some great mark of independence and accomplishment for us to be so isolated and for families just to see each other on holidays.
Well, I know that's changing, and I'm working on my own family relations, and I think we're seeing people moving back in with the parents due to the economic situation or, you know, for a variety of reasons. As I say, I think there are unstoppable changes for the better coming as well. We're going to have to wrap it up there. I'm Alex Smith. You've been listening to Jan Lundberg on Radio EcoShock. I check Jan's website, culturechange.org, pretty well every day to get a sane alternative to that mainstream news. Thank you for joining us, Jan.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been great.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our opening music, When the Great Correction Comes, is from Eliza Gilkison. Well, you know, you've really inspired me here, Jan, because I had the feeling that there's nothing we can do to stop the decline and the destruction, but you've also brought up the point that there's nothing we can do to stop the healing and the rearrangement that humans will make.
Don't let me down when the great correction comes.
That was Jan Lundberg, interviewed by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. And you can download podcasts of this show at unwelcomeguests.org.
We're dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations, dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations, dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Say goodbye to plastic and goodbye to cars. No more convenience stores. Hello to stars. No more Wall Street. No more Pentagon. Thinking about these things makes me happy. We're dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Goodbye to polystyrene. We'll bend to the waist. There is no time for debating. We have to case. If we're going to survive without computer program minds, we're going to have to can pop culture. And say hello to campfires and stomping bare feet and naked amoebas hungry to eat. Hello to primal consciousness and love for the land now that coyotes are running the country. We're dancing on the ruins of multinational.